CBS News Face the Nation in 60 seconds.
When was the last time you changed your home air filter? Did you know your home air filter can actually keep your home cleaner? Filter Easy solves the number one problem with home air filters: forgetting to change them. Filter Easy keeps dust levels down and helps filter out airborne allergens. With Filter Easy, you won't ever forget to change the air filters in your home again. You will also save 5 to 15% on home air conditioning costs by keeping your home air conditioning and heating systems cleaner. Get started today. FilterEasy.com is offering all the Face the Nation listeners their first delivery of standard 1-inch air filters at a price you'll love, and with free shipping. Never forget to change your air filter again and visit FilterEasy.com/FTN or enter code FTN on the homepage. FilterEasy.com/FTN or enter promo code FTN on the homepage. Filter Easy. You won't ever forget to change the air filters in your home again.
Today on Face the Nation, Republicans rush to secure votes for one last run at health care reform. The war of words with North Korea reaches new lows. And the president takes on NFL owners and athletes who want to wage a silent protest. We'll talk with Maine Republican Susan Collins, whose support is crucial for a new version of health care reform. Plus, Colorado's Cory Gardner. He hasn't made his decision either, but as head of the Republican Senate Reelection Committee, what's the political cost of Republican inaction? Congressman Adam Schiff is the top Democrat on the Intelligence Committee. He'll update us on the investigation into Trump staff ties to the Russians during the campaign. And we'll hear from Mark Short, the White House liaison to Congress. All that plus our political panel coming up on Face the Nation. Good morning and welcome to Face the Nation. I'm John Dickerson. It was a busy week for President Trump. It started with a confrontational speech at the United Nations Tuesday, where he threatened to totally destroy North Korea if the U.S. were forced to defend itself or its allies.
Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself and for his regime.
And condemned once again the Iranian nuclear deal agreed to by his predecessor.
We cannot let a murderous regime continue these destabilizing activities while building dangerous missiles.
President Trump followed up on that tough talk on North Korea by imposing sanctions on foreign countries that trade with North Korea in an effort to further isolate the regime and force them to the negotiating table. Friday, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un made a rare move of responding directly to the president. Trump has denied the existence of and insulted me and my country in front of the eyes of the world. I will surely and definitely tame the mentally deranged U.S. dotard with fire, he wrote in a statement. The president characteristically responded by Twitter. Kim Jong-un of North Korea, who is obviously a madman who doesn't mind starving or killing his people, will be tested like never before. Republicans are also making an 11th-hour effort to get a health care bill through the Senate before an end-of-the-month deadline makes it next to impossible to do so. The Graham-Cassidy bill would end the Obamacare mandate and let states come up with their own plans. But there are problems with the bill. No federal guarantee for people with pre-existing conditions, and the bill is being rushed through without knowing what it will cost and how many people will be affected. Republicans can only afford 2 no votes, and 2 have said they can't support it already.
That was a totally unexpected thing. Terrible. Honestly, terrible. Repeal and replace, because John McCain, if you look at his campaign, his last campaign, was all about repeal and replace.
Also late Friday, the president rushed into a new controversy, taking on pro football and the players who have protested racial injustice.
Wouldn't you love to see one of these NFL owners, when somebody disrespects our flag, to say, get that son of a bitch off the field right now, out, he's fired. He's fired!
NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell issued a statement yesterday saying, divisive comments like these demonstrate an unfortunate lack of respect for the NFL. We're joined by James Brown, CBS News special correspondent and the host of NFL Today. JB, the response to the president's comments has been pretty overwhelming from players, from owners. What are you hearing?
Pretty much what you just articulated, John, that from the commissioner, owners, and players, They have uniformly and universally disavowed those comments. You know, leadership, John, is about being a unifier, if you will, and engaging in vulgar, profane references to a group of young professionals who have been peacefully exhibiting their First Amendment rights is not the way to engage in civil discourse for the purpose of resolving longstanding, well-documented problems in their communities. And all they're aiming to do is to make sure that the first words of the U.S. Constitution, we the people, is inclusive, and they have those same rights and freedoms, John.
JB, what is your sense of how this gets resolved and keeps from escalating? Is there a collective role here, or is it up to the players, the owners, the fans, the communities? How do you see this getting better and not worse?
I think they all are involved in that. I've long articulated that there needs to be an inclusive discussion in inclusive groups, not in homogenous groups, all people the same ethnicity or color, what have you. I'm loving what coaches like Pete Carroll of the Seattle Seahawks has been doing, or Stephen Ross, the owner of the Miami Dolphins. Their aim has been to hear the players, to understand. They may disagree with the manner in which they peacefully articulate their concerns, but at least they hear them. Bill Cowher, you know, our Super Bowl winning coach, has said that as well, because it's about a team building effort where all right. benefit from that, John.
All right, JB, thanks so much for being with us. And now we turn to Colorado Republican Cory Gardner, a key voice for sanctions against North Korea in the Senate. He joins us from Yuma, Colorado. Senator, before we get to North Korea, I want to start with Graham Cassidy, the health care bill moving through the Senate that's likely to be brought up next week. Last week, you said that you were waiting for the assessment from the Congressional Budget Office. John McCain has said there's no way the Congressional Budget Office can give the numbers that would adequately tell what's going to happen with this bill, and that's why he's not supporting it. What's your position?
Well, I think there's still more information that we're looking for. I think the CBO will have a role to play in this. I believe there's information that will be coming through a committee hearing on Monday and additional text changes that will add additional information to HHS's analysis, the Health and Human Service analysis of the bill. So what we have right now in place for Colorado has led to double-digit health insurance increases. We've seen the insurance commissioner in Colorado certify increases of 27%. Insurance rates for next year. We've seen that on top of double-digit rates increased last year. It's unacceptable. So I hope we can find something, work together, put something in place that actually works to lower the cost of health care and increase the quality of care.
There have been some extraordinary quotes this week from your colleagues. One is from Senator Chuck Grassley, talking really about the blunt political calculus here. Senator Grassley said, "I could maybe give you 10 reasons why this bill shouldn't be considered, but Republicans campaigned on this so often that you have a responsibility to carry out what you said in the campaign. That's pretty much of a reason as the substance of the bill." Senator Pat Roberts, another of your Republican colleagues, essentially said that if this bill isn't passed, that Republicans would lose control of the Senate. And there's a New York Times piece in which you're quoted as saying, "Donors are furious. We haven't kept our promise." The picture that emerges from all of this is a rush for political reasons to support this and not substantive reasons. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, this has nothing to do with politics, has nothing to do with donors. It has everything to do with the people of this country who are suffering each and every day under a health care bill that is failing to meet their needs, that's bankrupting them. I meet with countless people across the state of Colorado, all four corners here, who are basically paying a second mortgage every month to afford their insurance, to pay for their insurance, that they can't actually afford to use. Half a million people in Colorado lost their health insurance, had their health insurance canceled, because they were told it wasn't good enough. It didn't meet the specifications, even though they wanted to keep that health insurance. And so we have a system right now that has led to higher costs, that has led to fewer choices in terms of being able to keep their doctors. People are paying $10,000 or more in deductibles, $8,000 in deductibles. They're paying $1,200, $1,500 a month for insurance. It's not working. That's the reason why we need new policy. That's what this fight is about. It's to make sure that the American people are better off.
But, Senator, there's been a great deal of opposition from the American Medical Association, from the directors of Medicaid in the states, to the substance of the bill. So all the problems you named can exist. But for this particular remedy, the criticism is that it's being forced through for political reasons. We all know from our reporting that there is great anger at the grassroots and at the donor level. And then you have senators basically affirming that. It seems hard to argue that there is not tremendous political pressure and that that's overweighing the substantive critiques to this bill.
Well, I think that the people who are opponents of the bill certainly want this to be about politics and not policy. But the bottom line is, for the past 7 years, we've made it a very high priority to put something in place for the American people of the Affordable Care Act that actually works. And that's what we have to do. Look, I hear stories from places like Holyoke, Colorado, from Denver, Colorado, from Glenwood Springs, Colorado, of people who have seen their health insurance premiums skyrocket. They lost the doctor that they were promised they could keep. The average family of four was told they would see lower health care costs of $2,500 per family a year. But that simply hasn't materialized. And so what's good policy is what matters to the American people. Now, if people are going to play politics, that's what they're going to do. But I think what we have an obligation to do as the Senate majority is hopefully bipartisan. People on both sides of the aisle will come together to pass a bill that works for the American people to lower cost and put something in place that works better than the status quo, because the status quo is simply not good enough.
All right. Let's see. We'll move on now to North Korea. You've been working on this issue for a long time, pushing for sanctions. Why do you think sanctions are going to work with North Korea?
You know, we have a long ways to go when it comes to the diplomatic runway toward North Korea. Last year, when Congress passed my legislation, the North Korea Policy Sanctions Enhancement Act, North Korea was the eighth most sanctioned nation on Earth. As a result of that legislation, it's now the fifth or fourth most sanctioned nation, meaning that we have a long ways to go to continue to ratchet up the economic and diplomatic pressure on North Korea and the enablers of North Korea. Our number one goal with North Korea, as it relates to North Korea, must and always will be peaceful denuclearization of the North Korean regime. We will stand to protect our great allies, South Korea and Japan, protect the U.S. homeland. But we have a lot of work to do on the diplomatic and economic side before we think of any other option.
But I guess my point is, Vladimir Putin said the North Koreans would eat grass before giving up their nuclear program, that they are uniquely resilient to sanctions. They've gone through famines with lots of loss of life and still haven't changed their way of behaving. Why will they now?
Well, Vladimir Putin ought to try to work with us to denuclearize North Korea. China needs to do a better job of taking responsibility to work toward denuclearization of North Korea. This is a regime that has made multiple promises over the past 20 years, a bipartisan failure. The last 8 years of strategic patience led us to where we are today with nuclear tests and multiple missile launches and an advancement in a ballistic missile capability. It's unacceptable to allow North Korea to maintain and retain a nuclear program. Why? It will lead to not only continued threats against the homeland, perhaps further than that threat, and it will also lead to proliferation throughout the area. I've already been approached by members of Korea's National Assembly to put in place tactical nuclear weapons by the United States on the South Korean Peninsula. If we are going to be avoiding proliferation in the region, which we must do, then we have to make sure that we continue to work with our partners around the globe to peacefully denuclearize the regime. China is responsible for 90% of the economy in North Korea. It's time they do more.
Quickly, Senator, just before we go, you spoke out about the president's tepid reaction to the violence in Charlottesville. The president has now stepped into the middle of a controversy about the NFL. I just wonder what you make of his remarks this week.
Look, I made it very clear in the aftermath of Charlottesville that there is no room in this country for hate, that the KKK, neo-Nazis, white supremacist groups are hateful. There's no room for them, and we must call evil by its name, and that is the KKK, neo-Nazis, and white supremacists. When it comes to this recent spat with the NFL, look, there are far more important things that we ought to be focusing on. You've mentioned them, North Korea, Iran, concern about the health care bill. That's right. What I'm going to continue to focus on, making sure that we take care of this country's needs in a way that people know they're better off.
All right, Senator Gardner, thanks so much for being with us. We turn now to Senator Susan Collins, who is leaning against the Senate health care bill. She joins us this morning from Bangor, Maine. Senator, you're waiting to hear from the Congressional Budget Office for it to give you its assessment of this bill. What is it that you're most worried about?
I really have three major concerns. One is the impact on the Medicaid program. This is a very important program in my state and many others because it provides needed health care to low-income seniors, to disabled children, and to so many of our most vulnerable citizens. And some of the projections are that $1 trillion would be taken out of the Medicaid program between the year 2020 and 2036. That would have a devastating impact, and the changes, the sweeping changes, have not been thoroughly analyzed by Congress. Second, I'm really concerned about continued coverage and protection for people with pre-existing conditions like asthma or diabetes or arthritis or cancer. This bill clearly weakens those protections, so it would depend on where you live. And you would still be sold insurance, but it might well be unaffordable. And finally, I'm very concerned both with the current law and with the proposed law about the impact on premium costs and on the number of people who will be covered.
So, Senator, that's a really long list. Is there anything really, given your experience and your knowledge of healthcare and the rush to get this done before next week, it just doesn't seem possible with your long list that that your fears can be allayed by anything CBO is going to put out?
Well, it is hard for me to envision getting to yes on this bill because my concerns are so fundamental. CBO's analysis in the past has been very helpful to me in evaluating bills, such as the previous bills that I opposed, and that's why I'd like to see it. The problem is CBO may have a very difficult time analyzing the bill because it still seems to be a moving target. Even over the weekend, the sponsors were making changes in it, and I think that's part of the problem. You can't, when we're dealing with a sixth of our economy and millions of people, you can't do sound health insurance policy this way. You need to have extensive hearings. The Democrats must come to the table, and that is what we should be doing.
There's one hearing scheduled for Monday, so in your view, that's not enough.
That isn't even close to enough. You know, the Medicaid program has been on the books for more than 50 years. The Graham-Cassidy bill proposes a dramatic, sweeping change in the way that program would be allocated and administered. And a program which does need reform, but we need careful reform. And I don't think this bill does that.
Your Republican colleagues say, on the record and off, that this might lose them control of the Senate. What do you think of that, if this doesn't pass?
I don't think that's the case. What Americans want is more affordable health care. And throughout this entire debate, it is so ironic that when the ACA was being passed years ago, and as we're deliberating today, that there is not enough focus on looking at the causes of escalating health care costs. And that includes taking a look at the rising costs of pharmaceutical drugs, and that is something that we need to do, way more focus on that. Mm-hmm. I think that the Senate Health Committee's done a great job in having four substantive hearings. We ought to proceed down that route and do a series of bills that fixes the current law, which does have a lot of flaws.
Let me ask you one last question. If this fails in the Senate and the current law stays in place, the Affordable Care Act, what obligation does Health and Human Services have, the Department of Health and Human Services, have to support the Affordable Care Act during the open enrollment period that we have coming up?
The department has to follow the current law. I hope that we can pass a bill this week that will be bipartisan, help stabilize the markets, help reduce the premiums under the leaderships of Senator Lamar Alexander and Patty Murray and those of us who are working hard toward that goal. But the administration does need to follow the current law until we change it.
All right, Senator, thanks so much for being with us, and we'll be right back in a moment with more Face the Nation.
Like what you're hearing? Get even more great content from CBS News Radio podcasts. Listen to TV broadcasts like The Evening News and Face the Nation on demand, or hear original audio programming like our weekend review show, The Weekend Roundup. Get politics, policy, and a side of pop culture with White House correspondent Major Garrett on our newest show, The Takeout. Get these podcasts and more from Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or Google Play today.
And we're back with California Congressman Adam Schiff, the top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee. Congressman, I want to start with a deadline that has passed. The committee has asked the FBI and the Justice Department three times now to give documents related to the so-called Trump dossier. This is the salacious set of allegations and the FBI has not responded. What's going on?
Well, this is a subpoena that was issued by our chairman, and what's unusual about it is the chair recused himself, or so we thought, from the Russia investigation. He's issued a subpoena to the Attorney General, who has also recused himself. So we have two people recused that are seeking documents or refusing to provide documents on an investigation they're supposed to be uninvolved with. But more than that, I think what is really at heart is an effort to discredit Mr. Steele. In essence, also to put the government on trial as a way, I think, of distracting our focus from looking into what Russia did during the election.
Mr. Steele being the author of that dossier.
Yes.
Let me ask about another development this week. Facebook turned over some information related to Russian efforts to influence the election. What exactly did they turn over and why is it important?
They're providing us with all of the commercials that Russia used on its platform. But I think what's important for people to know is there are a couple real significant issues here. One is, of course, the paid advertising, which was designed not only to help Donald Trump or hurt Hillary Clinton, but more fundamentally to divide Americans, to pit one American against another on some very divisive issues. It's the kind of cynical campaign you would expect of having a KGB operative running a country. There's a lot we don't know yet about it. I think we know only the minimum of the advertising. And, of course, advertising was only one method the Russians used on social media, and this was only one platform. But there's also an issue about the use of Facebook's algorithms and the way it tends to potentially reinforce people's informational bias. And this is a problem that goes well beyond Russia. But in one example, if you were looking or interested in an article about Hillary Clinton's health, would the Facebook algorithms result in your seeing a lot more stories about Hillary Clinton's health and reinforce a misperception or inaccurate information? That is a far broader issue than Russia, but one that we really need to know a lot more about.
And that's a Facebook problem, not a Russia problem. I mean, that's a problem with their algorithm that keeps us all siloed in certain narrow areas.
Yes, that there's certainly a Russian implication because they use these algorithms to amplify misinformation or slanted information. But it's far broader, and we have to ask, is this in our society's interest to create these informational silos?
What's the impact, though, of these Russian Facebook ads? I mean, is anybody saying that they had any influence on the election that changed the outcome in any possible way? It seems a small amount to have done anything like that.
Well, first of all, that small amount is only what Facebook has thus far confirmed came directly out of Russia. They have acknowledged that they haven't looked or analyzed or completed a report yet on advertising Russia may have done through third countries. So Russia will use proxies in the Caucasus or other parts of Europe to potentially buy ads or amplify misinformation. And of course, this is just one platform the Russians were using. This has nothing to do with the Russian use of bots on Twitter. So if you look at the full extent of Russian use of social media, was it in any way decisive or determinative? Hard to say because we really have so little information thus far about the extent of Russian use of social media.
Let me ask you about some other news that came out this week. There were reports that that Paul Manafort, the former chairman of the Trump campaign, was in fact wiretapped, two different periods. President Trump said at one point in a tweet that Trump Tower was wiretapped, and he was pretty much ridiculed for that. But now we have reporting that Paul Manafort was wiretapped. He had an apartment in Trump Tower. So maybe the president was right.
No, I don't think so at all. And in fact, not only did Director Comey and Director Mike Rogers of NSA say there was no truth to the president being wiretapped at Trump Tower, but the Department of Justice recently confirmed that was false as well. I can't comment on whether Mr. Manafort was ever the subject of surveillance of any kind. Even if he were, though, that just doesn't justify or suggest that the president was wiretapped improperly by Barack Obama. So there's no truth to that. I will say, with respect to Manafort, though, the allegation that he was reaching out to Russian oligarchs close to Putin and suggesting that he would offer them useful information to them while he was campaign manager, at the very same time the Russians are reaching out to him to offer information on Hillary Clinton, that is of deep concern to us.
But just going back to the president for a minute, I mean, he said Trump Tower was wiretapped, and Manafort lives in Trump Tower. I mean, it might not be precisely letter for letter what was going on, but it's a heck of a lot closer than what people were originally ridiculing the president for.
Well, I think this is far from, you know, an issue of whether it's letter for letter. The president suggested that Barack Obama was illegally wiretapping him. If the Obama administration was engaged in legal surveillance of someone they believed may have been an agent of a foreign power, we should want the administration to do that, and that's a far cry from the kind of illegal surveillance the president was suggesting.
An important question on North Korea. You oversee the intelligence communities. Mike Morrell, the deputy director of the CIA, former, who's a CBS senior analyst, says the U.S. may not know. North Korea may be further along. Do you worry about that, further along in their nuclear program?
I do worry about it. We have imperfect vision on what North Korea is doing, but we have to assume that in the near future they're going to be able to marry that nuclear technology with their ICBM technology. So whether they're further ahead, we have to presume that may be true, and we need to act accordingly.
All right, Congressman, thank you so much for being with us. We turn now to the White House Director of Legislative Affairs, Mark Short. He is the liaison between the administration and Capitol Hill. Mark, welcome to the broadcast.
John, thanks for having me.
I'm going to pick up with something that Senator Collins said about pre-existing conditions. She says they are not guaranteed in this legislation. The president, when we spoke to him in April, said this health care bill that passes will have a guarantee, but this one doesn't. So the president's okay with that?
This one does, John. In fact, the Obamacare legislation required coverage of pre-existing conditions. This legislation does not change that. So pre-existing conditions continue to be covered.
So the critics of the bill say that's not the case. While the Obamacare protections may exist, states can opt out. So they can apply for a waiver. And then when they get that waiver, the terms that they have to meet are really fuzzy. And people who are involved in healthcare know that because it's really hard and they're going to have to squeeze out a lot of money, they'll take the path of least resistance, which means people with pre-existing conditions will see less coverage and higher costs.
Okay. John, look. This system's not working. Everybody knows that having Washington, D.C. as a central hub for this has failed. It's failed the American people, and prices are going out the roof. In Arizona, prices have increased by 190% over 4 years. In Alaska by 203% over the last 4 years. To your question, we guarantee pre-existing conditions continue to be covered. You're right that there is also an ability for states to apply for a waiver. But in that, it's conditional upon them showing how they will continue to make pre-existing conditions covered on an affordable basis. There's also federal dollars that are provided to help states to do that. But nobody can deny that costs right now are going through the roof.
But leaving aside, there are plenty of problems with the bill, as people on both sides say. But on this question of pre-existing conditions, the analysis from the AMA, from the AARP, from the Medicaid directors, they look at it and they say, what's going to happen is the vagueness of this language, which says that a state can opt out if it offers an adequate and affordable alternative, that is a huge hole through which states will increase costs, lower coverage for the most. We're talking here about the most vulnerable people with pre-existing conditions. So if I'm out there with a pre-existing condition, and this is, of course, what Senator Collins was talking about, there's no backstop here. There's no guarantee. Someday down the road, it's going to get worse, and people would like some kind of surety, and all they hear is vague words about affordable and adequate.
John, the current system is unsustainable. The Medicaid dollars are going to go bankrupt. They're continued to predict a 6% increase annually that this country cannot afford. So it's no surprise that the special interests are opposed to it. The same special interests in those trade associations you mentioned went to bed with the Obama administration to force Obamacare on all Americans. Because why? Because it forced all Americans to have insurance whether you want it or not, and an individual mandate, and all employers to force force coverage on all their employees. This is something that they like the current system, and they want the government to continue to give more dollars. Now they're asking for bailouts on the CSR payments. That's what they want. That's not what's working for the American people. We need to change the system.
But anybody with a pre-existing condition is not wrong to think that their costs might go up and their coverage might decrease.
They will continue to be guaranteed coverage, John. That's what we've said. The law does not change
that. But it might be quite
that.
Different from the coverage they have now because of this opt-out that a
likely
state can
the
do.
Coverage they have now is not working. The system is not working. Coverage for millions of Americans is not working. That's why last year 7 million people chose to pay the penalty instead of get the terrible insurance that's offered on the Obamacare exchanges.
Well, those
they don't
people
want
with
it.
Pre-existing conditions.
Those are people that are
those
saying
are healthy people.
There's a mix of people who are saying they'd rather pay the penalty than have to pay the taxes.
Let me ask you about the president's push for this. He spent 90 minutes in Alabama this week. He talked about a wide variety of issues. Why does the president, who's a marketer, who has some skills in that regard, not go 90 minutes on the benefits and beauties and wonders of this plan? He talked about how hard he was working. He has a list of people he's jawboning. But why is he not out there selling this plan for all of its great merits? Is it because there are not merits that he can sell to his voters?
Oh, no, I think he actually is selling it, John. I think that he's had many calls with those senators who are on the fence. He's continued to make calls to the weekend. And you saw his activity in the first go-round. So he's continued to stay active. In reality, the whole Graham-Cassidy effort, it came to be because the first effort failed. And a lot of our voters are saying, look, this isn't good enough. Yeah. You promised us for years you would repeal this.
But here's a president who's got, on the phone, I'm sure he's got talent, but he's the rally guy. He's the 90 minutes whipping people up. He's talking about the NFL. Today, now the owners and teams and everybody's responding to the president who says something on the NFL. Isn't that totally getting in the way of your effort to fix this health care issue and get all the Republicans on board?
No, the president's a huge asset to our efforts on Capitol Hill. He's not getting in the way.
But the NFL issue is a useful one in terms of health care?
Look, I think the NFL one is an issue where the president has made a case that, as we've talked about, there are coaches across this country at high school level who are penalized and disciplined for leading their players in prayer. And yet you see an issue in the NFL where the media champions those who are taking a knee to disrespect the American flag. That is a dichotomy that most Americans can't understand, and for good reason. And the president's raising attention to that.
But he raised attention to not the prayer issue, but pointed out to players. I mean, you mentioned the prayer, but he didn't.
Well, he's making the case that in many cases, there are generations of Americans who have fought and died to protect our freedoms and fought and died for the red on that flag that represents the blood that's been sacrificed by so many Americans. And what the president is doing is saying, this is not the appropriate place to raise your social activism. And I think he's made the case that you have a First Amendment right, if you wish, to protest the flag, but owners have a First Amendment right as well. They have a First Amendment right to fire those players if they so choose.
All right, Mark Short, we're going to have to leave it there. We're out of time. Thanks so much for being with us.
John, thanks for having me.
In the latest healthcare debates, you've probably heard the term regular order. John McCain said the lack of regular order is why he's not supporting the most recent bill. Regular order is Washington jargon, but it basically means doing things the agreed-upon way. At the bank, you expect the line you stand in to order the turns of those waiting for the teller. When you visit the DMV and the rules change each time, you feel a glowing rage. In Congress, regular order is the process for tackling tough problems, studying them, applying expertise, and then arguing the issues on the merits without personal attacks. It's also a mindset for a place where everyone has to work together the next day. It sets the conditions for heated arguments so everyone feels heard and respected. It grounds debates in the values of the institution, fairness, equality, justice, which temper the passions of the moment. Regular order doesn't always lead to compromise, but compromise is less likely without it. Regular order doesn't always mean less partisanship. Partisan hotheads can still hijack the public process. But without regular order, people get suspicious of the final product. Losers feel cheated and invited to undermine the law. If laws are to be followed, it's odd to pass them in a process that says the rules don't matter. But if voters want the compromise available through regular order, they have to be patient. It's messy, slow, and imprecise. It was designed that way. In most formal meetings, if proceedings descend into chaos, a participant can get things back on track by shouting, "Regular order!" Though people may not know the term, they've been calling for it in Congress for a long time. We now want to bring in Dr. Atul Gawande of The New Yorker, who asks, is healthcare a right, in this week's issue of the magazine, out tomorrow. Welcome. You, for this piece, went back home to report on healthcare. Why?
So back home for me is in southeastern Ohio, and I went back home because this is a territory that's I grew up in a blue dot, Athens, Ohio, in the middle of a red sea. We went for Trump. And my friends, I went and spoke to them to ask them what they thought. Do they believe healthcare is a right? And a surprising number said no, even friends who'd been bankrupted by healthcare costs, because they believed that it was really a way to ask them to pay more for other people while they couldn't afford their healthcare costs. So they weren't hearing that it was a way to help them.
Now, in the debate we're in this moment, I just want to step back a minute. We're not even asking really that question, are we? I mean, over, say, Graham-Cassidy, that's just not being asked, is it?
That's right. It's disconnected from the goals and the troubles that people have now. You know, the criticisms on the show are legitimate. You know, the people I talk to, friends who are still earning less than $20 an hour after 20 years in a job, are sending half their paycheck in for taxes and paying for a premium for crappy insurance that's $3,000 deductible, $50 copay, and meanwhile their taxes go to pay for someone who may not be working, who has Medicaid coverage that is better than anything they could dream of. No copays, no deductibles, no premiums. Now, the interesting thing to me, though, was that they distrusted the government to solve this problem, but they also were strong supporters of Medicare. Okay. And understood perfectly well that it was a government program. The key thing that they saw was that Medicare wasn't about a right. It was about the idea that we all contribute, we all pay our tax in, and we all benefit and benefit fairly. And right now for what we see is everybody gets an astonishingly different deal for something as important as their health care, their health and survival.
So essentially the difference is Medicare, no freeloaders, because everybody's got to pitch in and they're worried about the freeloader problem.
That's right, and that everybody's in the same deal. The broken part of the system, the thing that we don't talk about, is that the link that we have made that you get your health care through work is breaking. That link is breaking because it leads to very different deals. We have to create all these systems for what if you're disabled? What if you're in a small business, can't afford it? What if your employer doesn't cover you? What if you're self-employed? Second reason it's breaking, 94% of net job growth since in the last decade is in jobs that are that don't come with health benefits. It's freelancers and temporary workers, independent contractors.
So given the reporting you've done and these differing views, as you said, even for people who've been bankrupted and had to scratch for 5 years to get back on the right side of an illness, is there a solution, a bridge that you found between the different groups?
Well, the fact that people see in Medicare their values being enacted suggests our pathway forward. The critical parts of it is building trust in order for that bridge to get there. So what people don't talk about, you know, what one person said to me is the left doesn't talk about the cost and the right doesn't talk about the need. And none of them want to talk about how do we transition to getting there. There are approaches. You can transition to making sure that outside of work, you can get coverage through Medicare. You have a state like Nevada that passed, but the governor vetoed, letting people buy into Medicaid. Or you could say healthcare.gov, make that the open system that we can all buy into, pay into, and share equally in being able to get that kind of coverage. We have to stabilize. I agree with both the Republican and Democratic view that you need a bipartisan effort to stabilize the current system. Now, it's actually straightforward ways to do that. And the Senate, Alexander and Patty Murray effort to make that happen is a critical first step. But then you have to build and do the thing we're not doing now. The message I heard from people is that it's the public debate and also the public hearing process around solutions like allowing buy-in or transitioning to allow states to make this passageway.
Help people understand what stabilize means for the Affordable Care Act, because they may not understand what that means and why that's important.
Yeah, I mean, all the things that people are pointing to right now, premiums are going up. Why are they going up? Because the insurers are uncertain. Is the government going to enforce the mandate? Is there going to be subsidies to ensure that people who can't afford their deductibles, that they aren't bankrupted along the way? Those basic components haven't been nailed down. There's total uncertainty what's supposed to happen. And providing some certainty brings the premiums down. There have also been programs that people have tried everywhere from Minnesota to Alaska that have allowed for reinsurance plans that allow for the very high cost patients to not end up driving up the cost of a single insurer. Right. So there are some technical approaches that allow you to smooth out the costs and stabilize where we are now. It clearly, though, is the only the beginning pathway to being able to open up the system that deals with the fact that job-based coverage is breaking.
Final question. You mentioned a lot of different states, Minnesota, Nevada. I know you've written about different efforts in Wisconsin. This is the Republican argument that the federalism let 50 experiments bloom and let that work. So it sounds like there's nothing that may be a good approach.
There's nothing inherently wrong with that. You know, I look at this. I'm a surgeon. I have mainly a cancer practice. Before reform, 1 in 10 of my patients were uninsured. And then after they had their diagnosis, they now ran into having pre-existing condition exclusions. I, since reform, have seen no patients who face that problem anymore. Zero. Now, any of the approaches that we have, whether we want to push it to the states or want to and say the federal government's going to get out of their responsibility but hold the states to certain standards, or that we're going to try to open up Medicare more widely, any of those approaches need to ensure that we are clear about the a line around the core values of people we're talking about. What are the costs to everybody? Are we sharing in the burden equally? And then how are we transitioning so we don't hurt people along the way? We are at risk in every plan that has come forward right now. We end up making people in the system worse off in the name of supposedly making it better.
All right, Atul Gawande, thank you so much for being with us. And we'll be back in a moment with our panel.
Check out CBS News Radio podcasts. From hard news to features, there's lots available from our app. Listen to experts like John Dickerson each Sunday on Face the Nation or Anthony Mason every weeknight on the CBS Evening News. There's the World News Roundup, America's longest-running network newscast, and the Weekend Roundup, our Week in Review magazine show. It's all available from cbsnewsradio.com or on our app for iOS and Android.
Joining us now for some political analysis, CBS News senior foreign affairs and White House correspondent Margaret Brennan and Washington Post White House reporter David Nakamura. David, let me start with you. We'll start with NFL. It's Sunday. Is this just President Trump being President Trump? What do you make of this?
Look, I mean, he picks the fights with a lot of people, but we saw he did this in his speech in Alabama, where he was purportedly down there to endorse a Senate candidate, Luther Strange, but it got a great, you know, a rise from the audience. And, you know, what struck me is that it's one thing to, he picks a fight with the NFL over Colin Kaepernick, which sends a certain kind of signal. The next day, he amplifies that by attacking Steph Curry. And I was just looking at the sales of jerseys. Steph Curry is the most popular player in the NBA when it comes to sales of jerseys. So this is a player who has broad support. You know, Colin Kaepernick is a controversial figure, but now he's sort of expanded that much broadly, and you see the sort of backlash. Now you have even the owners of the teams that have supported Trump, like Robert Kraft of the Patriots. And it's not clear what Trump's endgame is here in picking this broad fight.
Right. And Margaret, there may not be an end game. It's the crowd went wild. The crowd sees these protests as anti-patriotic, as Mark Short articulated here. Is this just the way Donald Trump is? He could have spent some time talking about health care. He didn't. He could have talked about taxes. He did, but not in a way that sells either one of those programs. So where do you think this goes next?
Well, it's tax reform week, and that was a heck of a kickoff to it. Talk about being off message. But the president clearly thinks in some ways rhetorically this works for him, perhaps because it diverts attention from two very tough fights and his recent frustration with Capitol Hill. This may be something that resonates, but it also in some ways reopens some of those questions, concerns, and analysis of what the president actually meant back during the Charlottesville controversy. Why reopen some of those questions? Why have people compare, well, you didn't criticize Tom Brady when he said, of the Patriots, when he said he wasn't coming to the White House. Why are you targeting some of these other players for raising concerns on that end? And so it is a distraction, and it's one that's going to play in to mass culture. People who don't follow the ins and outs in healthcare and tax reform, they know who plays for the NBA and NFL, and they're going to care about this.
And David, speaking of healthcare, where does this fit? As Margaret mentioned, this we're supposed to be moving into tax reform. This is now kind of on in tender situation with you've got two Republicans who said they won't support it. Susan Collins certainly felt like sounded like she wasn't going to support it. So what happens this week?
Looks like it's going to health care is like a third round that's going to go down. It really appears. And I think that's going to put all the more pressure on Republicans and this president who is really wanting a win somewhere, somehow. To make something happen. We've started to see the details now of the tax reform come out. The president has promised this is not going to be a tax cut for the rich, but we're already hearing about the top rates coming down. At the same time, they're talking about doubling the standard exemption for the middle class, which could be popular. So this is something I think that Republicans and the White House and Congress is really united on for Republican leadership. The question now is whether they can do it. And if not, whether he turns to Democrats for immigration or other things.
And you do have the White House quietly acknowledging they're not going to get to that 15% corporate tax rate that the president had campaigned on. It's going to be a bit higher, in part because they're dealing with a different mathematical set here because they didn't get health care done.
before we move on to international affairs, Mark, what do you think is going to happen with DACA? I'm thinking about, you know, you've got the healthcare fight, the tax fight. Those are going to be pretty partisan. Right. But a week ago, we were talking about 2 weeks in a row.
Chuck
the president
Nancy.
Had made deals with the Democratic leaders. One of them was on deferred action for childhood arrivals. What's happening with that deal?
We haven't heard much, to be quite honest with you. But you're exactly right, because while you hear Senator McCain talk about returning to regular order and this hope in some ways of getting bipartisanship on certain issues, that was a brief shining hope for a moment there with the president brokering this deal with Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, not only with keeping the government open and funded, but the promise of getting this immigration reform done. That doesn't seem to be the signal being sent right now on health care. Just yet. And it's not clear on something that is this iconic in many ways to those on the left as Obamacare, whether they are willing on this particular issue to reach across the aisle and fix a system that even President Obama said needed some improvement.
So, David, on tax, quickly on tax, the Republicans will be back in line, though, because McConnell, Ryan, yep. and the president are pretty much in the same
right.
place, right?
Right. Absolutely. I think this is a chance for the White House to try to work with the leadership, provide leadership. One of the things that's been said about the healthcare debate is the White House is not providing leadership, has not sort of taken authorship of some of the key tenets of this. I think with tax reform, you're seeing more of that. Of course, as Margaret said, the president threw out this 15% corporate tax rate. We're not going to get there. There's now being floated that could be 20, but that would still be a significant reduction. I think the White House is going to move all heaven and earth to get there.
Margaret, at the United Nations this week, the president challenged the North Korean leader in pretty tough language. Was that a strategic plan, or was that an audible by the president? Where does things stand with North Korea right now?
Well, it's clear that General Kelly has not succeeded in turning off cable news. while he is changing the information flow to the president was able to brand this, in his words, as sort of a rocket man on a suicide mission. That was the phrase that got repeated over and over and over. That was a takeaway from the speech. The takeaway was not the United States is open to diplomacy to settle this issue. And so the president's words did undercut the message that Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, has been trying to push here, which is we're actually not trying to take you out of power. We're actually not trying to overthrow your regime, and you shouldn't fear sitting down at the table with us. The president sent a very different or else kind of message from the podium of the United Nations, which is supposed to be an institution aimed at peace building and collective action.
And said they would totally, potentially totally destroy North Korea.
Right. That was not intended. It had been in and out of the speech, the Rocket Man reference, but the takeaway, the focus on diplomacy was definitely.
And the president also said, we're still demanding the complete denuclearization as a prerequisite for these talks, something that I think has been something the North Korean regime has made clear that they're not going to agree to ahead of any kind of talks.
Margaret, 40 seconds left. Iran, give me your thoughts about that this week.
Well, this meeting, the first time you had Iranian and high-level U.S. officials, Rex Tillerson and Nikki Haley, in the same room with Iranian officials, did not present any kind of proposal on what the president is planning to do, which is to decertify Iran's compliance with a nuclear deal. They listed their complaints, but they have not presented a pathway out. I'm told the White House is looking at how to deal with Congress and how to manage the fallout here, because Congress could reinstitute sanctions if the president follows through on that threat to decertify next month. So we have a lot of worried partners in this Iran nuclear deal who are also saying, China's one of these partners here. Are you going to break your deal with China on Iran and ask them to help you in North Korea?
All right. Thanks to both of you. As we say goodbye this week, a personal note. This week, our Face the Nation family is grieving, along with our colleagues, Kim and Greg Schaefer, for the loss of their son, Mason. We all knew Mason. His parents have worked on this broadcast and for CBS for more than 30 years. Mom as a producer-editor and Dad as our lead audio man. Our hearts and thoughts and prayers are with them and their daughter, Kira. Mason Schaefer was 22. Today's guests were Maine Senator Susan Collins, Colorado Senator Cory Gardner, and Congressman Adam Schiff. The executive producer of Face the Nation is Mary Hager. The senior producers are Jill Jackson and Ed Forgetson. The broadcast was directed by Brian Nailsnick. Face the Nation originates from CBS News in Washington. For more Face the Nation, we're online at facethenation.com. And you can follow Face the Nation, John Dickerson, and CBS Radio News on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Face the Nation is also rebroadcast on our digital network, CBSN, at 11 a.m. and 6 p.m. Eastern every Sunday.